This is The Record with Steve Scheer. I'm Ross Reynolds. Imagine you found yourself on a train platform in India. A train was just pulling away. You notice you don't have a ticket, and you don't know who you are. You'd probably pinch yourself and hope that you woke up. But when David Stewart McLean had that experience in 2002, it was not a bad dream. It was his reality. You might remember the This American Life story that he told. Now David Stewart McLean has written a book about the experience. It's called The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a Memoir of Amnesia. David is a Penn American Award-winning writer, and he hails from Chicago. Thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you came to, so to speak, on that train platform, what did you retain? What did you still have?
I think, like, one of the things that, like, our identity provides us with is a way of creating a hierarchy of data, incoming data. So when I woke up, I didn't have that hierarchy. And so all data, all sense data meant the same to me in a way that, like, the train meant the same as much as a pigeon meant the same as the guy making an omelet behind me. It all pertained to me in a way. And so it just sort of felt like I was dilated. And I could just sort of swallow as much data information as I possibly could.
You knew it was a train, though, right? And you knew it was a pigeon?
Yes, that's. I still had my semantic memory. I still knew what words were. I still knew, could speak English, still had my motor skills, just had no sense of who I was or why I was there.
Did you know enough to be scared in that moment?
You know, when I very first woke up, no. Like, it was fine. It was just sort of like sort of just swallowing the world up. As soon as I realized I didn't know what happened next, that's when I got terrified. Because in order to know what happens next and what you're going to do next, you need to have an identity, a narrative. And if you don't have that, you don't have any way to sort of sort any of the data that's coming in, and instead you just realize how much chaos the world is at all moments.
A man on that train platform obviously noticed you were somewhat confused, and he thought you were, like, unfortunately, many young people who end up in India end up as kind of drug casualties. That was his assumption, and as you write it, you started to think that was the case too.
My brain was so starved for narrative. For any sort of narrative about who I was. You know, Rajesh, the tourist police officer, just figured I was another pharmaceutical tourist in India you know, a white guy sort of out of his mind on a train platform. That's not a crazy thing for him to think. And so when he said that to me, my brain, which was so desperate for any sort of narrative, made up an entire narrative of made up a person, this woman, Christina, and she and I would do drugs together. And I was so sad about it. And I was I felt terrible. I felt like I had wasted my life. And Rajesh sort of scolded me and then took me to a guest house where he and this woman held an impromptu intervention to get me to stop doing what I was doing.
And you created that narrative in your head immediately, too, by their suggestion.
Absolutely, because I needed something. I needed to know who I was, and Rajesh told me who I was and the kind of person I was. And so I took that on. And then when Mrs. Lee, the owner of the guest house, told me the story about her son dying from a drug overdose and was crying, I realized what an awful person I was and how horrible I'd treated my mother and how horrible I had wasted my life, only to find out none of that actually happened.
Yes, they found your wallet. They called your home in the United States. They put you on the phone with a man they said was your father.
Right.
What was that conversation like?
I was so sorry. I was so sorry, and I was like, Dad, I'm so sorry. And he was like, we talked to you Tuesday, Dave. Like, you got nothing to be sorry about. What are you talking about? And it turned out I was there in India on a Fulbright, on a writing Fulbright, and not taking drugs.
How did losing your memory affect your ability to write?
I think for the longest time, Well, I think a lot of the muscle memory of writing was a big way in how I reformulated my personality, because I had spent years like developing characters and figuring people out that way. I was able to do the same for this character of me. And so I sort of made this character of me, and I built this character of me through the photographs that my family had at the home, through old emails. I was actually able to sort of assemble a working self out of what other people thought of me.
How did it come back? I sort of imagine a picture in developing and slowly more detail filling in.
It was more like, I guess this is what I, in some ways, like you can't know what you don't know, right? And you only know what you don't know until you're confronted with it. And so when I first got back to Central Ohio, I was where I grew up, I was confronted with all that I didn't know. And I could see that I didn't know it and then try to figure out what that thing was. Now, 12 years later, how much I don't know, I don't know. Mm. But I still run across people who from before that time that I sometimes don't know. And I don't know if it's still the result of the larium or if it's just because it's 12 years ago.
You mentioned the larium, and here's kind of the key to this whole thing. Larium was a treatment for malaria, and that triggered this in you. Is that right?
It was the prophylactic that the State Department, the FDA, and the CDC all said that I needed to be on. And its generic name is mefloquine, and has a really long, twisted history of doing things like this.
And part of this book is looking into that twisted history, because you are not the only person who had this horrible, bad effect from taking this malaria drug.
In fact, the more I research, the further I researched into while writing this book, I actually was one of the lucky ones. There have been a lot of suicides on larium, and there have been a lot of homicides on larium. Some of the side effects are aggression, paranoia, and confusion, and suicide. Suicide's a side effect.
Is larium still out there? Is it still being used and suggested for?
It is. It's still being used. And in some places, if you're going to a place that has cerebral malaria, which will kill you in 2 days, it might be worth risking some of these side effects of larium for it. It's no longer sold under the name larium. It's sold under its generic name mefloquine now. The U.S. military developed it. And so a lot of the military are still on it, even though the U.S. military keeps saying that they've stopped. Just a month ago, CBS News released a document saying that the U.S. military was still prescribing it to troops.
There's no FDA prohibitions against its use? There's no warnings out there?
There was a black box warning in July of 2013 that got put on the drug that said that the physical side effects, which can be like tinnitus, constant vertigo, and some other vestibular side effects, can become permanent. This took a really long time to get the black box on there. And it's really only a matter of time before they figure out that the psychological side effects can become permanent. I still have anxiety, panic attacks, and insomnia that I never had before.
And how about your memory? How long from that moment on that train station platform did it take until you felt at least somewhat adjusted or back to knowing at least who you were and who you knew and where you worked?
I think it was about 3 weeks before I figured out enough that in order for me to continue, I needed to fake being sane.
What's that mean?
The thing is, it's like most people at any moment in your life, they really just want you to be fine. And they want you to be fine, and they genuinely do. And if you're not fine, it means more work for them. And I'm not saying that's bad, but it's just more work for them. And so if you're terrified, like I was, of ending up back in the mental institution, you want to convince everybody you're fine. And if everybody wants you to be fine, then all you really have to do is shut up. And it's a scary lesson, but like it's something that I learned that in order for people to think I was sane, I just stopped talking for a while. Did you just agreed with everything everybody said around me.
you must have had to unlearn that at a certain point and begin to talk about it.
Right. I had to unlearn that a lot, especially in writing about this book. I didn't talk about what happened to me for a really long time. And when I did, I would just tell it in funny stories, like this William Powell-esque romp through India that I had. Mm. And I had to instead like learn to tell it in the awful way that it happened.
These are all the awful things that happened, but did anything good come out of having gone through this experience? I mean, it's an amazing experience to write about.
Yeah. I think one of the good things might be I was able to see who I was objectively, and I don't think a lot of people ever get that chance. I was able to see the decisions I had made and the person I was making myself into, and I decided to make different decisions decided to stop being as glib and flip as I used to be.
It's an amazing story, much deeper than a Dick Powell romp, and it's called The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a Memoir of Amnesia. David Stewart McLean, thank you so much for telling us about it. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is The Record on KUOW.